Orlando, come back. Don't be childish.
I'm not being childish, I just don't want to talk.
You're being really childish. Just come back.
Can you leave me
alone?
Can we
talk about this?
Look, no.
Can you just stop and wait for a second? Listen, it's not that I'm anti-alliteration, but, you know, it's just...
Ha. See?
What?
You're even doing it yourself.
Well, that's unintentional.
It shows that it's deeply ingrained in your subconscious.
Oh, come on, that is pure projection. Oh, shit.
Just come out and say it. You think alliterative devices are old-fashioned.
I just don't like too heavy a reliance on them. I mean, Orlando, I think you have a problem.
Oh,
there, I've said it.
I've got a problem. Here we go again. What problem have I got? What problem?
You're an alliterative fetishist.
What? That means that I'm a fetishist who happens to use alliteration. No, you mean an alliteration fetishist.
No, actually, I meant the former.
In any case, what's your solution? You're stating the bleeding obvious, yeah? Episode 3, The Sea. Oh, what originality. What scintillating rhyme. The syllable count isn't even right, is it? How about Episode 3, The Rolling Sea? And that would have been much better.
Sometimes simplicity is best. But look, can we let this go? We've got a show to do.
Yeah, okay, I'll tell you what. You get on with the introduction. I've still got some serious sulking to do.
Oh, God. Hello and welcome to the Poetry Pod. My name is Izzy.
And I'm Orlando.
And we're two people who like poetry.
Love poetry.
Right. Who love poetry, and we want to share that love.
With you.
In our first season, we'll be looking at British culture through the lens of poetry. Welcome to the Poetry Pod. Season 1, Britain through the Bards. We've got a fantastic show for you today, even though Orlando's still sulking, but I'm sure he'll get back to us. We'll be meeting Matt Panesh here in Morecambe, and we'll be talking about Morecambe Bay, the stuff that goes on here. There'll be quizzes, obviously. There'll obviously be brilliant poetry, and we might get some fish and chips.
Did you say fish and chips?
Yeah. And if you stop sulking, I'll buy you some.
Oh, now there is an offer I cannot refuse. The jugged hare suddenly feels like a distant memory. Oh, Izzy, I'm sorry. Let's put this behind us. Let's bury the hatchet.
Good idea.
I feel a bit better now. Shall we bury the hatchet by doing a poem together?
That's fantastic. You know what? Let's do a really negative poem, grumpy poem, to get all the negative energy out of our systems.
Absolutely. Have you got one in mind?
Yeah, you know, A Sea Dirge by Lewis Carroll.
Good idea.
Lewis Carroll, A Sea Dirge. There are certain things, as a spider, a ghost,
the income tax, gout, an umbrella for three,
that I hate. But the thing that I hate the most is the thing that they call the sea.
Pour some salt water over the floor. Ugly, I'm sure you'll allow it to be. Suppose it extended a mile or more. That's very like the sea.
If you like your coffee with sand for dregs,
a decided hint of salt in your tea,
and the fishy taste in the very eggs,
by all means, choose the sea.
And if with these dainties to drink and eat, you prefer not a vestige of grass or tree, and a chronic state of wet in your feet, then I recommend the sea. For I have friends who dwell by the coast, pleasant friends they are to me. It is when I am with them I wonder most that anyone likes the sea. They take me walk, though tired and stiff, to climb the heights I madly agree, and after a tumble or so from the cliff, they kindly suggest the sea. I try the rocks, and I think it cool that they laugh with such an excess of glee, as I heavily slip into every pool that skirts the cold, cold sea.
Yeah, it didn't sound like much of a fan of the sea, did he?
No, not really.
So, not a very good start, actually, to our podcast this week, because, I mean, obviously, we want to extol the virtues of the sea. So Lewis Carroll was not to be found near the sea, clearly.
Yeah.
I think his sentiments are pretty similar to those of the Ancient Mariner.
The Ancient Mariner?
The Ancient Mariner, yeah. Come on, surely you know the Ancient Mariner, is he?
Yeah, but, I mean, doesn't
Coleridge's epic?
Yeah, but doesn't that have, like, 60 verses?
Yeah, it's relatively long, but, I mean, it's a seminal work we cannot ignore.
Yeah, but it's too long for this show, isn't it?
Yeah, okay. I can feel it coming. You probably want me to summarise it in 2 minutes, is that right?
Yeah, I mean, what happens in the poem, right? There's not that much that goes on. You've got a wedding, weird uncle shows up, mopes about the time at sea, and, you know, when he killed that albatross, curses everyone, wedding ruined. Thanks. That's the poem.
Well, but I mean, your summary skills are phenomenal.
Right.
You've put a bit of a negative spin on it.
Right, okay. Listen to this. You get to do your two favourite verses.
Two favourite verses?
Yeah.
Okay. We seem to have a fetish for the number two. I'm going to do it. Okay. Two favourite verses. I can think of a cool part of the poem. Okay, listen to this. For when it dawned, they dropped their arms and clustered round the mast. Sweet sounds rose slowly through their mouths and from their bodies passed. Around, around flew each sweet sound. They darted to the sun. Slowly the sounds came back again, now mixed, now one by one. Sometimes a dropping from the sky, I heard the skylark sing. Sometimes all little birds that are, how they seem to fill the sea and air with their sweet jargoning. And now 'twas like all instruments, now like a lonely flute. And now it is an angel's song that makes the heavens be mute.
That was four.
You were counting.
It was.
Okay, but can you tell me what was going on there? What picture did that conjure up for you?
It did, you know, it still sounded a bit negative, wasn't it? Wasn't it the sort of, you know, the vast sea, and then wasn't exactly a positive description of the sea, was it?
Basically, what happens, it's not positive, I've got to be honest. What happens is all of the, they set out to sea, and by shooting the albatross, allegedly at least, the ship becomes becalmed, and everyone starves, and basically everyone other than the Ancient Mariner dies.
That's such a happy poem.
Well, but the interesting thing is, that's why I chose this particular part of it. All of the dead men come to life in spectral form and form a choir, and they sing around the mast. I mean, it's beautiful in a macabre sort of way.
Yeah, that's very... listen, I'm feeling a bit peckish. Maybe I'm too hungry for grand poetry.
It's the sea air.
I think the chippy's over there.
Where?
You know, back all the way back there.
What, over there?
Yeah.
Well, I can't see any. I can only sort of shimmering haze. I feel like I'm in the Sahara Desert.
Yeah.
Looks like it's 2 miles away.
Yeah.
Speaking of the number two.
Yeah. Well, shall we do a quirky quiz while we walk?
Nice alliteration again. Yeah, excellent idea. Why don't we do that?
Cool.
Hang on, I'm just going to take off my shoes and socks because it's really nice, actually. Okay, yeah, go for it.
Right.
I'm up for it.
Literature and sea pub quiz.
Okay.
Starts easy, gets more difficult towards the end because okay. Obviously I still have to beat you.
Okay, yeah, okay.
In the whole quizness business.
The quizness business, very nice.
Right, so... Question one.
Right, I'm all ears.
What's the name of the whaling ship commanded by Captain Ahab?
That's a good one.
Mm-hmm.
The whaling ship commanded by Captain Ahab. I can tell you the name of the person who wrote the book. I know it. I know it. Can I leave it and come back?
Yeah, let's
okay.
do that. All right, second question.
Yeah.
On which body of water is Hemingway's The Old Man and the Sea set?
Hmm.
Where does it take place?
Which body of water? Is it the Atlantic Ocean?
Can you be slightly more specific? It's like...
Hmm.
you know, which...
Which part of the Atlantic Ocean? Well, I mean, Hemingway was obviously American. So I'm assuming it's somewhere off the coast of North America. Am I right? Are we thinking Nova Scotia, that sort of area, or are we thinking down towards the Carolinas?
More towards the south.
Florida? Caribbean?
Where is it? It's off the coast of Cuba.
Off the coast of Cuba?
Yeah, it's Cuban fisherman who struggles with the marlin.
Good heavens. Do I get a point for that? It's sort of a bit cloudy.
Yeah.
Half a point.
We'll see how you do with the other questions.
Okay.
I'll give you half a point.
Oh, okay, it's very generous of you. I'm still trying to think of the name of the whaling ship.
Yeah.
Still at the back of my brain.
Right.
But working its way through the limbic system. Carry on.
Question 3. In which novel do scientists discover a sentient sea planet? It's a big planet.
Do scientists discover a sentient sea planet?
Yeah. Sci-fi novel.
A sci-fi novel.
Yeah.
It wasn't made into a film, was it?
It was.
It wasn't a spectacularly bad film that failed.
It.
It's not Waterworld, is it?
No, it's not Waterworld.
Oh. No.
It's not by a British writer, if that helps.
No,
it's not,
okay.
Not even an English language writer.
This is very difficult. Your quiz is very hard today. You're getting the hang of it. I don't know. I have to be honest. I don't know.
It's Solaris by Stanley.
Solaris. Yeah. Yeah, no, I did know that.
Yeah.
Oh, darn it. Darn it. Okay. You're doing very well. I've only got half a point so far.
Ooh, and those were the easy questions.
Yeah.
Oh,
God.
Right.
The chippy's getting closer, by the way.
Yeah, almost there. Right, question 4. Who was the first writer to mention Atlantis, the sunken state city?
The first writer?
Yeah.
Was it Jules Verne?
No, longer ago. I'll give you another hint, because
it's
very difficult. He's also a philosopher.
Oh, you're talking about ancient Greece, or...
Right. Yep.
Okay, was it... let me think. Would it have been somebody like Archimedes?
Getting closer. It was Plato.
Plato?
Yeah, he uses sort of... You know, a story to illustrate hubris of a state, because Atlantis tried to attack Athens, and then the gods got upset and sunk it.
Okay, so Plato. Of course, Plato did everything, didn't he? So
exactly.
Would have been a
good
guess.
Who did X? It was probably Plato.
Yeah. I'm doing miserably badly in this. I definitely need something to eat. Okay.
Right. I'm going to change the final question, but can you name one of the main pirates in the Asterix books?
Pirates.
Yeah, there's the pirates that always attack Asterix and Obelix.
No, I mean, I know about the Romans. I mean, it's always Caesar and a few of the Romans, but the pirates.
Yeah.
No, I know that the name of the chief in English is Vital Statistics because he's very fat. But no, I've no idea. What are they called?
They're called Redbeard, Pegleg, which is a very inventive name. Pirate Lookout.
Pirate Lookout.
That's a great name. And Eryx.
Eryx. Okay, with an X on the end, no doubt.
And you know what's really interesting about them is that there was a Redbeard comic in Belgium about, you know, pirates.
Okay.
And the Asterix pirates are actually a parody of that original comic book.
Oh, really? Okay.
But now they're more famous than the original.
Because of that, okay.
Because of that, yeah.
Cool. So coming back to Herman Melville and Moby Dick, the whaler, you're going to have to give me some help. Can you give me a clue?
It comes from a Native American language of the same name. Well, it's almost the same
Native
name.
American language. No, it's going to be just too tricky. I'm thinking of tribes of Native American Indian tribes. No,
it's not one of the well-known ones. It starts with a P.
No, you're going to have to help me.
It's Pico.
No, I wouldn't have got it. Okay, how do you spell it?
Pequod.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, it was actually in a pub quiz I took part in back when there were still pubs and quizzes.
Yeah, exactly. When was that?
And my housemate actually got that right.
Pico. Pico. You pronounce it Pico, yes? Pico.
I think, yeah.
Pi-quad.
Pi-quad.
Pi-quad. Pi-quad.
Pi-quad.
Okay. Speaking
of pies.
Yes. We're getting very close now.
Very close.
Izzy, So, I mean, being a German, obviously, your knowledge of the sea and the seaside will be limited to the to the Baltic, to the north.
Yeah,
and the
North Sea. Closest sea to where we live is the Mediterranean. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
So you have to go to Italy.
So you have to travel through many European countries to get there. But you, I mean, what's your experience of the sea in the UK? Because I mean, surely you have some.
Yeah. I mean, it was really nice living. I spent a year in Canterbury studying there. And it was so nice just, you know, having seagulls outside the window. And you could, it always felt like a holiday to me because I'd only ever hear seagulls on a holiday.
It's a lovely thing to wake up to, isn't it?
Yeah.
Hearing that sort of, the moaning of the seagulls. Yeah, super.
And actually, if you look across Morecambe Bay, over there on the horizon, you can just about make out the other side of Morecambe Bay, which is where Barrow in Furness is.
That's right, yeah.
And I went to school there for 3 months.
Did you really?
10 years ago.
You're a mine of fascinating trivia. I never knew that. Yeah.
and I was there in winter, so it was obviously always raining.
Of course.
Or freezing cold.
As it should be in a British summer.
Exactly.
It wouldn't be the same without it.
And then I went back in April once to visit my friends there, and my friend Becky and I got ice cream, sat by the beach. It was a lovely sunny day, and the next day I had a sunburn.
That's incredible.
In the north of England in April.
You should have gone straight to the press. They would have written a long report about it.
Local press, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what are your sea memories?
Oh, I have loads, because I grew up fairly close to the sea in Devon. And for me, the sea, I don't know, packed lunches, I suppose, are the sort of indelibly etched upon my taste buds. So things like picnics, hard-boiled eggs encased in salt, cheese sandwiches also encased in salt, sausage rolls.
Encased in salt.
You took the word right out of my mouth. Crisps. Mm. Which you didn't need to have salt with, and various things. I mean, I used to love, and still do if I have the opportunity, going swimming in cold sea.
Mm-hmm.
So I did a job once, an opera festival on the Isle of Man, and I used to go in October, and I went swimming in the Irish Sea every morning, and it was about 10 degrees, something like that.
Cold.
I came out less of a man than I went in, let's just say, put it that, like that. But I felt fantastic for the rest of the day.
Yeah.
So I can highly recommend that. Yeah, and I love it. I have so many memories, which I will not go into now, but going surfing with friends and going there with girlfriends. And I had some very nice times.
Mm-hmm.
But if I go into that, I'll start getting melancholy and nostalgic.
Aww. Actually, like talking about the sea, it really reminds me of a show I saw at the Fringe 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah.
Anime Fringe by a poet called Faye Roberts.
Mm-hmm.
And the show is called The Selkie. Do you know what Selkies are?
I have no idea what a Selkie is. What is
they're
a Selkie?
Sort of mythical creatures that live in the sea.
Mm-hmm.
But then they can also come on land and take off their hide and dance on the,
on
the seashore like humans.
Sounds fantastic.
But then if you steal their hide, they can't go back into the ocean.
So then what happens? They stay where they are?
Yeah, they have to stay on land.
They follow
you around.
Do you have to marry them?
And that's actually, and I found the show online. Faye put the entire show online as an audiobook to listen to.
Okay.
Do you want to hear one of the poems?
Let's do it. Let's do it. We still have time. We still have time. We're at least 400 yards away from the chippy.
Yeah.
In the midst of war they formed a child, wild-haired, wide-eyed, partaking of their every nature, but she looked different. No one could put their finger on it. Their colours intermingled, alchemised something that was neither. In the crackle of ozone and the hot salt crash of birth, they had unearthed a Selkie child. And some or other attending angel, some craven deity, laid fates on her. That she would always pay the greatest price for everything she held, that she could be loaded with more than you could possibly know and still run up hillsides, and yet each grain of her burden would lay bone-deep burns. What is a Selkie? Well, maybe you've heard of them before, blended with other names. Skin-shifter, shape-changer, seals that leave their seas and skins to dance naked on lonely shores, a twisting tumult of bright laughter, dark-sea fishers, rock-warners, storm-callers, great liquid eyes and sighs to melt hearts. Want a wife? Steal a pelt from a selkie as she walks in human form and keep it safe for all time. Want a child? Let your eyes slip 7 tears into the sea on a moonless night, and your lover will come to you, dark and salt wild. This is the tale of a selkie. They barely ever end well. This one was pale and weak-looking, a stranded seal bereft of buoyancy in these safe new waves so far from her native waters. Maybe that's why her mother wanted to keep her from the open sea, afraid she'd lose her to the wild dark, the cool of tides. No matter how hard you try, nature or fate tends to prevail. Maybe our Selkie's mother panicked, wanted to wrap her from tragedy. Maybe some other soul stole her skin. We'll never know. If they did, no one told the Selkie what she was, what she missed, but her flesh hissed with incompleteness, and she felt its lack. This child taunted definition, walked in mist, a skinless skin shifter who loved and feared the open water, growing to delight in thunder and the crash of waves against the cliff's edge, and yet was drawn to fire's filigree and shout.
Oh, gosh, that was a huge wave, but it has not washed any selkies up.
It's quite a destructive force, the sea, isn't it?
It can, at its worst, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You know, we've talked about A.E. Houseman quite a lot.
He keeps coming up
in the show, but he also...
finds his way into our shows, doesn't he?
Yeah, sneaks in. There must be, like, maybe the ghost of A.E. Houseman's following around.
Certainly is,
Yeah, he wrote a poem, obviously, about the sort of destructive power of the sea. Seeing that the shippy doesn't seem to get any closer.
It's now 350 yards away.
Yeah. You want to hear another poem?
Yeah, absolutely. Let's have a little bit of Houseman.
Yeah.
While away the hours.
A. E. Houseman, smooth between sea and land. Smooth between sea and land is laid the yellow sand, and here through summer days the seed of Adam plays. Here the child comes to found his unremaining mound, and the grown lad to score 2 names upon the shore. Here on the level sand between the sea and land, what shall I build or write against the fall of night? Tell me of runes to grave that hold the bursting wave, or bastions to design for longer date than mine. Shall it be Troy or Rome I fence against the foam, or my own name to stay when I depart for aye? Nothing. Too near at hand, planing the figure sand, effacing clean and fast cities not built to last, and charms devised in vain, pours the confounding main.
Well, I'm a great fan of Houseman. I really like his poetry, but he...
Cheerful as ever.
I'm getting more depressed as we speak. I think any selkies that might have been washed up will be running straight back into the water.
Yep.
So what's he saying? He's saying that nothing lasts.
Exactly. Like, don't even bother building anything because it's going to be washed away.
Brilliant. Don't bother setting up a chippy on the shore of Morecambe Bay because it will be washed away.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, okay. But I tell you what, I'll counter that melancholy sort of doom and gloom with Edmund Spenser from his Amoretti. And no, I'm not talking about a small biscuit that goes with your coffee. So Edmund Spenser, I think he says exactly the opposite in this sonnet. So let's go through it. I tell you what, will you play the part of his lover?
Oh, of course.
My lover, in fact. Don't start getting any ideas. Edmund Spenser from Amoretti. One day I wrote her name upon the strand, but came the waves and washed it away. Again, I wrote it with a second hand, but came the tide and made my pains his prey.
Vain man, said she, the dust and vain essay, a mortal thing, so to immortalize. For I myself shall like to this decay, and eke my name be wiped out likewise.
Not so, quod I, let baser things devise to die in dust, but you shall live by fame. My verse your virtues rare shall eternize, and in the heavens write your glorious name. Where when as death shall all the world subdue, our love shall live, and later life renew. There, doesn't that make you feel a bit better now?
Yeah, that is definitely better. I mean,
shall I write your name in the sand, Izzy?
Yeah, please do.
Or shall I write Pyquod?
Pyquod?
I don't even know. I've forgotten how to spell it. I won't be writing Pyquod, but speaking of pies, we have arrived at the chippy. That's smelling good, isn't it?
Ah, oh, it does. But, oh God, that line is eternal.
It's a bit of a cue, isn't it?
Man.
Certainly is. Must be. But that is a good sign. That shows that it's
a good chippy.
What is on today? What's special? How about an albatross and chips?
Albatross and chips.
Speaking of the
favorite.
Ancient mariner.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is going to take a bit of time, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I wasn't banking on this, so we've walked 500 yards to get to the chippy, and now we've got a queue of approximately a tenth of that.
Mm.
I don't know. How can we kill some time? Limericks? How about some limericks?
Yeah.
You know any good ones?
I've got
a rude one.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Okay, seeing as this is a politically correct show. Okay, this is for all cricket lovers out there. I will not explain the limerick. I think it's self-explanatory. The boy stood on the burning deck. The crew were playing cricket. The ball flew up his trouser leg and hit his middle wicket. There you are. I'm not going to explain that. Can you understand that?
Yeah.
You've got the general gist.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll leave it there.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. So should we make it a challenge? Whoever writes the better limerick
gets what?
I don't know.
A 99 flake.
Oh, yeah. Why not?
Yeah. Shall we explain to our non-British listeners what a 99 flake is?
I mean, I know how much you love explanations, so go ahead.
No, but hang on a minute. Have you had a 99 flake?
Yeah, of course I have.
Yeah, then why don't you explain?
Oh, God.
I want to break the mold of Orlando explains everything. Why don't you explain? What is a 99 flake?
Ice cream, one of those, you know, soft... In Germany, we call it soft ice. Cause it's
very German.
Soft ice.
Yeah.
So that makes
it does exactly
sense.
What it says on the tin.
Yeah. And then you've got the flake is like... flaky chocolate, sort of like chocolate folded, very thin chocolate folded over.
Yeah, it's like a sort of bar, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's chocolate. Yeah, and you sort of stuck in the side of this soft, whippy ice cream.
Mm.
And it's wonderful.
It's really good.
It is a really nice thing. Yeah, I don't know who came up with the idea. It's a phenomenal idea. Anyway, so the winner gets a virtual 99 flake. Obviously, we can't give you one. We're not going to send you one either. So just imagine that's the prize. What is a limerick? I suppose we should define the rules of this game.
Oh.
We've moved approximately 1 meter closer to the chippy.
I can sense another lengthy explanation.
Okay, you've explained 99 flakes. I get to explain.
Oh, now I see why I got to explain the 99 flakes. It was a build-up to you explaining the limerick.
Careful, strategic move on my part. Exactly. I tell you what, if you've had enough of me explaining stuff, I will, hang on, get my mobile out. Let Britannica.com do the explaining. Hang on. Limerick. Yes. Okay, here we are. Limerick. A popular form of short, humorous verse that is often nonsensical and frequently ribald. It consists of five lines, rhyming A-A-B-B-A, and the dominant meter is anapestic, with 2 metrical feet in the third and fourth lines and 3 feet in the others. The origin of the limerick is unknown, but it has been suggested that the name derives from the chorus of an 18th century Irish soldier's song, Will You Come Up to Limerick? To this were added impromptu verses crowded with improbable incident and subtle innuendo. Did you like that alliteration? Improbable incident.
Fantastic.
Could have been one of mine.
Did you write that article?
I did not write it. That's Britannica, right? That's Britannica.
Yeah.
So enough on the anti-alliteration.
All right, so here's one of my fantastic 10-second summaries. A limerick is basically a poem that goes da-dum, da-dum, da-dum.
I think that's what Britannica is trying to say, but you've obviously put it in much more
rhythmical.
Yeah.
You know, explain. Yeah.
Should have become a teacher.
Right.
Brilliant.
Right, so, but I'll need a second to think about a limerick.
Okay, so you're going to write a limerick. I'll write one too.
Yeah, about fish and chips.
Good idea. Okay, cool. Let's do that.
We are now approximately 10 meters closer to the chippy. Mm-hmm. There are approximately 15 people in front of us, mm-hmm. and a lot of them are ordering rather large amounts of mm-hmm. chips. So why don't we have a little break? I'm going to get out my thermos flask. Mm-hmm. Do you want a cup of tea?
Yeah, amazing.
Sure. Hang on. Here you go. And have a drink. And while we're doing that, we'll drink a little bit of tea and compose our limericks. Mm-hmm. I'm not feeling that creative today. Mm-hmm. Okay, let me think. Okay.
Got one.
Yeah, I'm quite mm-hmm. happy with this one, actually. Mm-hmm. See what you think of this.
Right.
A nice piece of fish with some chips is perfect on most seaside trips. But dropped into batter, your clothes it will spatter and do funny things to your hips.
Hmm.
Did you like that?
Yeah, that's a good one. All right, here's mine. There once was a cod in the sea who desperately wanted to flee. A little while later, he got put on a plate where he finally fell free.
Lucky cod.
Yeah.
Before being gobbled up. Yeah, very nice.
There was a young man from the bay who could never keep this fish on the tray. When he reached for the batter, the fish fled the platter, and that's how the skate got its name.
Oh, hi, Matt. Didn't see you there.
Oh, wow, Matt. Is that this is Matt, is it? Oh, good heavens. Yeah. Hi. Nice to meet you.
Hello. Pleasure to meet you.
That was a superb limerick.
Thank you very much indeed. You're drinking a cup of tea. That reminds me of something.
Tea. Yes, it was worth the brutality, the Indian suppression, for this little bag of bliss, or the Englishman's confection. You see, back in the early days, the East India Company, responsible for Britain's tea, had its own army to guarantee the regularity of supply. Ah, the cup of tea. Not only does it taste marvellously, but you see, symbolically. Even though the contents of the cup may change, do not think it strange that whether it's fabric, or diamonds, or oil, or mineral wealth won through business, or spoils, it'll all come over like a cup of tea, whether it's Chinese, African, or Iraqi. You see, proper tea is theft.
Oh, I think we're up next in line for the fish and chips. Matt, do you have any recommendations?
I would definitely go for haddock chips and curry.
Ooh.
Curry? I've never had. Curry. Have you ever had curry in your fish and chips?
It's a controversial decision. However, I find it one of the most English dishes we have. Haddock chips and curry.
Okay, make that three.
Brilliant.
Here we are. Here we are.
Oh, that's good.
That's yours.
Thank you.
And Matt, here's yours.
Thank you.
Super. Well, this had better be good. This had better be good. This is a new recommendation, Matt.
It's a whole new taste sensation.
I bet it is. I've never tried this before. So, well, look, let's walk and talk. You're the expert here. You live in Morecambe. Where should we walk to?
I'd say let's go to the Stone Jetty, walk past the beautiful Midland Hotel, our little Art Deco palace.
Yeah, wonderful.
Ooh, brilliant.
Sounds good. Let's do that.
Yeah. All right, Matt. So, what brought you to Morecambe? How did you end up here?
Like most people from the northwest of England, desperation. Desperation. I literally had nowhere else to go. I got evicted from Manchester. The entire city just went, don't come back. And I kind of, like the other flotsam and jetsam, from Manchester and Liverpool, I kind of woke up dazed on Morecambe Shore with a couple of bags and wondered how the hell I got here. And then the strange thing is, when the choice came to leave, I didn't take it because I absolutely fell in love with the place. It's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. So yeah, desperation. But now I feel a real sense of belonging.
Oh, that's fantastic. But you, I mean, I imagine one of the reasons you sort of fell in love with the place was you started a couple of cultural projects here, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. I, it's a very strange place. I don't know if you know about the comedian Eric Morecambe. So there was the show Morecambe and Wise from the 70s. Yep. Well, Eric Morecambe took his name from the town that he was brought up in. So this is where he was from. His real name's Eric Bartholomew. And when I came here, as you know, Izzy, I've seen you up in the Fringe several times. There's a statue of a comedian in Morecambe, but there was no comedy night at all. And this place was built for entertainment. It lies exactly between Edinburgh and London. And so it was the overnight stop on the steam choo-choo train. So there was theatres here, there was all sorts. And it'd all gone by the time I arrived. So I thought, that's terrible. It's like a cultural black hole. So we started the Fringe here just to see if people were interested and whatnot. And it's been really good. We started off with 15 shows in 2017 over a couple of days. And that's now grown to pre-COVID. It was going to be 100 shows over 3 weeks, and 15 of which would have been our own shows that we'd have developed in Morecambe with the people that live here. So they've really sort of taken to it well. So yeah, sorry, I get witter a bit.
No, you witter away. It's very good. By the way, these curried chips are fantastic. It really is a great sensation.
Yeah. I'm so glad you're enjoying them all, Andy.
I really am. I'm worried a little bit about the after effects, but we'll come to that later. So how many of the shows that actually appear on your show in your festival, how many are local, would you say, and how many do you have from further afield?
Well, yeah, so it would have been 15 would have been local, and 100 would have come from further afield, and 100 would have been on the way up to Edinburgh. That's what we had booked in at the time. Last year, obviously, it was a wipeout, and this year I think we're going to be an electronic festival, which has led neatly into my next project, which, if I can grab my bag and open it and show you, inside there is about £3,000 worth of camera equipment, and we've just started a project called Fringe Factory Films, which is going to be taking people... The one thing I noticed last year in COVID is, because I've just started a streaming channel that's going to be launched later on this week for America and Canada, there's an absolute dearth of well-filmed fringe shows or fringe artists. They just don't have the quality of footage. So we've gone out and got cameras, and what we're going to do is, instead of filming a live performance, which we possibly will do, but instead of making it just a live film, try and make an adaptation of a fringe show into a film, like a hybrid of the two, a bit more like an art house movie, if you like. And I think there are plenty of acts out there that could do with that kind of thing. Plus, we've got the streaming channel to put them on as well, so as a way to monetize them. So that's kind of the new thing, if you like, but it's very new.
So it'll be a kind of a mélange between a film and a kind of variety performance, in a sort of slightly higher brow sense, of course, but weaving all of those different things together.
Exactly that, Orlando. And I think there's an appetite for it, certainly from the viewer side of things. And I think there's an appetite for it for the performer type thing, because it'll actually support their shows rather than be a filmed version of the show. Why would I go and see it live? It's going to be an adaptation of it, just as you would do a radio play or anything like that. So I'm really quite hopeful for it.
Cool. Nice. Oh, I see we've arrived at the stone jetty. Oh, that's nice. Really nice view from over here.
Where are we? Which direction? Sorry, I just wondered which direction we're looking out at here, Matt. What are we looking at?
We are looking straight across at the Lake District, which is those hills over there. If you go to your left, you'll see Barrow. Right. And then we've got the open sea and island over in that direction. But directly across from us, there's the Lake District. It's a World Heritage Site. It's glorious. It's one of the best backdrops you can imagine. My dad actually took me to Morecambe when I was about 11 years old. He worked on the nuclear power station, which was being built. And we have the most spectacular sunsets here over the Lake District. I just hope it's got nothing to do with my father's handiwork.
It might be a little bit of... A little bit of leakage, perhaps. Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
Well, that might explain. Izzy was explaining in the last episode or this episode that she had a very, very good suntan after going to Barrow in Furness. That might also be explained by your father's presence
True.
In the area.
That's it. Yeah.
Oh, fingers crossed that isn't the case. But as long as the skin stays on, that's the main thing.
She has a permanent tan. I mean, go figure.
So, Matt, looking out at the sea, what does the sea mean to you? You've obviously lived close to the sea pretty much all your life.
I don't know. What does the sea mean to me? I love to go swimming in the sea. I love to go skinny dipping in the sea. Not so much in Morecambe Bay because the houses are right there. But it's always got that sense of renewal for me and that sense of birth. I always look at the little floating bits that are in the sea and think that's where we came from. Not just we, but everything on land, on the planet, came from the sea in the first place. And I find that it's the waters of our womb, collectively.
Beautiful. Lovely alliteration.
Thank you. I love a bit of alliteration.
So do I. Brothers in arms.
But I suppose, I mean, for the UK, the sea also sort of means, you know, the separation from the continent, right?
Absolutely. We are an island set in a silver sea, as they say. And boy, are we acting like an island at the moment. Let me tell you about Brexit.
No man is an island, said John Donne. But this island is set in a silver sea that doesn't want the tea growers here, just the tea. An Englishman's home is his castle, and we build them in the sand. We've planned to take our borders back, and now we have. There's no plan. A gull cries. A fisherman stands stranded, looking out. You can't sell fish or shellfish to the EU anymore. Ordinarily, he'd rise to the bait, talk about sovereignty, give you a right hook. But now, dangling on one, an oyster sticks in his throat.
Oh, what a fantastic poem. That was great.
I think we've got to somehow get that in the sixth episode as well. It's absolutely fantastic. It's getting a bit parky now. I'd quite like to make a fire. I guess we can't make one here on the stone jetty, can we?
No, not at all. But I tell you what, I've got a perfect spot for it. If we just go over to the battery bay, follow me. It's okay. All right. Come down the steps of the stone jetty. The water's not in. It's just there. We'll be able to get to the battery bay. Perfect space for a fire. You can't be seen by any of the houses. It's great. Everybody leaves you alone. It's a lonely spot. It's my perfect spot.
Wonderful.
Brilliant. Matt, do you think we can get some booze as well to go with our bonfire?
Absolutely. Leave it to me. I'm off on the booze run.
Fantastic.
See you in a minute. Okay, off Matt goes. Does he like drinking alcohol? I mean, he seems to be very enthusiastic about getting booze.
I think, good on him. Say that, yeah. Right, we should probably get some firewood for that fire, right?
There's not a lot of wood here, is it? What are we going to do? There's plenty of plastic.
Yeah, seaweed.
Does it burn?
Seaweed.
You can eat it. There's an old chair over there. Hang on, there's an old chair. I'll go and get that.
Oh, nice.
And I know what we could. We've got the fish and chip wrappers. We could start a fire with that.
That's pretty good.
Okay. Yeah. Tell you what. Okay. So I'll go and get. While we're gathering stray bits of driftwood, why don't I? I've got a quiz for you. I've got a few literary sea questions for you. Mm-hmm. I've done miserably this week. I've got 0.5 out of how many?
Five.
Oh my God! Terrible. You can only win.
Yeah.
You can only win, right? Tell you what I'm going to do, though. I'm going to do it a little bit with a twist this week.
Oh.
I'm going to ask you, I'm going to give you five quotes. I'm also going to tell you five names of five literary figures.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to put the quote to the figure, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right?
All right.
You're going to be able to do that. Have you got a pen and paper?
Yeah.
So one hand for collecting wood, one hand for writing things down. Yeah, go on, write it on there.
Okay.
All right, here we go. Well, I'll read out the names of the authors. Okay, here they come. Herman Melville, John Masefield, William Wordsworth, Joseph Conrad, and Samuel Beckett.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm going to read out the quotes, and you've got to match quote to author.
Mm-hmm.
Here comes the first. Oh, there's a nice bit of wood there. Hang on a sec. Let's pick that up. Okay. There is nothing more enticing, disenchanting, and enslaving than life at sea. Okay, that's the first quote.
I'm just going to take some notes.
Here comes the second one.
Mm-hmm.
The ocean is a mighty harmonist.
Okay,
here comes the next one. I must go down to the sea again, to the lonely sea and the sky. And all I ask is a tall ship and a star to steer her by.
I know that one.
It's a song, actually. It was set to music. Here's a clue for that one. It was set to music by John Ireland. I used to sing it. It's a lovely song. Should have started the series by singing, the episode by singing. Okay, here's the next one.
Mm-hmm.
There's never an end for the sea.
That's it?
No, there's one more.
That's it.
Yeah. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. And last but not least, there is one knows not what sweet mystery about this sea, whose gently awful stirrings seem to speak of some hidden soul beneath.
I'm just going to write down that's probably Wordsworth.
Okay. Very good. Well, you've... Okay, hang on. Oh, lovely. A huge piece of wood here. Just going to pop that over to one side. Right, so Izzy, come on.
All right, so final one. Probably Wordsworth, because there were many, many words, some of which I understood.
Okay, so and you think that's
out of
Wordsworth?
Those five, I'd say that's Wordsworth.
So the fact that you can understand it qualifies it as being Wordsworth. Interesting argumentation. No, okay, so you think that's Wordsworth, good.
Right, then the third one I'm pretty sure is Masefield.
Okay, which one was that?
That I must go down to the sea again.
Okay, you think that's Masefield, right?
Yeah. Then I feel like there's never an end to the sea.
Mm-hmm. Who do you think that was?
I think that's Beckett, because it's very, very sort of, you know, sort of dry, short.
Yeah.
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 Prosaic.
There's never an end, like waiting for Godot. Yeah.
Mm, exactly.
He never comes. Yeah.
You
might be right. You might also be wrong, but yeah, carry on.
And then I'm thinking the ocean is a mighty harmonist.
Mm.
I think that's Melville.
You think that's Melville?
And then that would leave the enticing, enslaving sea to Conrad, the first quote.
Okay. Well, I'm happy to tell you that you have got 3 out of 5. Well done.
Great.
And you officially have won this week's battle. It had to happen at some point, didn't it? I'm going to have to go back to my studies before our next episode because I'm very embarrassed. Okay, the one you got wrong, you did very well, but the ones you got wrong, the ocean is a mighty harmonist.
Mm-hmm.
That was Wordsworth.
Oh.
It's nice, actually. Very short for him, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
The ocean is a mighty harmonist, Wordsworth. Consequently, there is one knows not what sweet mystery about the sea, whose gently awful stirring seem to speak of some hidden soul beneath. Of course, it must be Melville.
Yeah.
Hidden soul, Moby Dick?
Well, you know, yeah, fair enough.
You know, Pyquod.
Pyquod.
Precisely. So there we are. But you did extremely well. Well done. Well done. Yeah. Okay, so I think we've got enough. Can you hand me all of that stuff over there?
Yeah, there you go.
Thank you very much. Let's put all this together quickly. Can you give me your chippy wrappers as well?
Yeah.
Let's just going to stick this underneath. Okay. Let's see if this lights. It does. My gosh, and that wood is really...
Nice.
Gosh, it's going up very fast.
Ooh,
who'd have thought it? And the sun is going down. Those fish and chips were also very good, weren't they?
Yeah, really nice.
So we're looking out to sea now. We're probably looking out in the direction of the Isle of Man, Ireland, can see the Irish Sea is beautiful, isn't it?
And you get the best sunsets here, right? Because we're facing west.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Sun-sinking. We should have gone up to the Isle of Skye or somewhere like that. That would have been even more beautiful. It's lovely. This actually takes me, watching the sun setting, makes me think of a very famous poem by the longest-serving poet laureate in British history. We talked about Masefield being the second longest. Who was the first longest? The first longest? My English is improving. So who was the longest-serving poet laureate?
Tennyson.
Yeah, very good. Yeah. Today's your day, isn't it?
Today's trivia day.
I might even give you 4 out of 6 for that. Mm. Sort of unofficial sixth question. Mm. Right, okay, so the poem it reminds me of is called Crossing the Bar. And Tennyson, just for a tiny little bit of background, I'll go into it, you'll be pleased to hear more after the poem. He had a house on the Isle of Wight. And in order to get to the Isle of Wight, you have to cross the Solent, which is a little stretch of water between the British coast, the South English coast, and the Isle of Wight. And it's a very sort of metaphorical poem, and written very, very near to the end of his life. Crossing the Bar by Alfred Lord Tennyson. Sunset and evening star, and one clear call for me. And may there be no moaning of the bar when I put out to sea. But such a tide as moving seems asleep, too full for sound and foam, when that which drew from out the boundless deep turns again home. Twilight and evening bell, and after that the dark. And may there be no sadness of farewell when I embark. For though from out are born of time and place, the flood may bear me far, I hope to see my pilot face to face when I have crossed the bar. So, what does that poem say to you, Izzy? What's he talking about?
I mean, it's kind of sticking to the slightly depressing theme, aren't we? You know, I hope to see my pilot face to face across the bar.
Yeah. Who's the pilot?
God,
very good. Yes, exactly. Yeah, and you know, he insisted that that poem be, I think at the end or at the beginning of each book of verse that he published, until he died. I think he wrote it 2 years before he died. Mm-hmm. He was an amazing character, Tennyson. You know, he had a huge history of mental illness in his family. Poetry was escapism for him, he wanted in 18. He born in 1809, 1832. He sort of been in the wilderness really, and he decided he wanted to make poetry his career. But his dad died, his best friend died, and then basically for 10 years, he drank, he smoked, he had a huge fear of epilepsy, which ran in the family. Obviously, suffering from grief and depression. He went to hydropathic hospitals for treatment, but he married, and after he got married, it seems to be the case that everything changed for him. So obviously his wife did him a lot of good, and sort of mid-1840s, best known for things like In Memoriam in 1850, and in 1851 he became poet laureate after, who in 1851? A poet who features on every show that we do.
Wordsworth,
yeah. He became poet laureate after William Wordsworth. And he lived in Farringford on the Isle of Wight. He was very good friends with Queen Victoria. And he was, in 1883, the very first poet to be made a peer, a lord. Mm-hmm. And he went from zero to hero. He was, you know, he could have, you know, died young because mm-hmm. of all of his habits. And he ended up being incredibly famous in his own lifetime. Literally very, very famous indeed. And he wrote this poem sort of 2 years before his death. So very evocative, I think.
I think there really is a very special atmosphere about the sea at sunset and at night, you know, when the stars come out as well.
Wonderful.
You want to hear another poem by Faye Roberts?
That's the Selkie poet.
The Selkie poet.
Yes.
They've recorded
another album with a musician called Anais Bukhanovsky.
Mm-hmm.
And the two of them sort of brought together poetry and music. And I think it's very sort of, it's got a lovely atmosphere. It's about the morning rather than night, but still, yeah, beautiful piece. It's called Song to the Sea.
Wonderful. Sounds very meditative.
A glance disarms my invention. My tongue tangles itself, tripping me to drown headlong in two eyes, like the sea at sunrise, the exact colour of a long, drawn-out summer dawn in Orkney reflected. Brain neglected, I happily bob and sway shamelessly, well, nearly, adrift in the sea of your regard. That small shame, that crimson shame threads through the blue like spice, cutting those cool sensations with hot, sharp intentions, the edge to every catching breath, striking deeper and deeper into my chest with every push and cresting wave, and every tug and sighing release. Oh, my love, for you I'd turn sailor, learn to read the weather of your ways and ride the tides of your affections. No longer shipwrecked, I'd reconstruct your gifts, those glances given, smiles bestowed and words exchanged, and on that craft of sighs and hungry nights, I'd traverse you until I lost all sight of land, and there, rocked on the belly of the murmuring mystery, I'd weave my net of words and music and cast to catch the moonlight glinting from your wave tops and bring it home with me. Come, mermaid, and I'll sing to you, to tell you of a love between the elements. You'd see me true and sure to you, holding, encircling, delineating, but never limiting, smiling as again and again you throw yourself into my arms. And when your fingers turn my cheek with a sigh like all the world's hurt easy.
Oh, nice fire, guys. Well done.
Thank you. Who'd have thought there would be so much driftwood in Battery Bay? Fantastic.
Have a couple of cans. Get your laughing gear around that, as they say.
Cheers. The perfect segue to curried chips.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Oh,
that's
great.
A nice drop, that.
Oh. I've got to tell you, just staring in the fire makes me think of all the people that we've lost along the way. You know, I lost a friend of mine just recently. And the strange thing is, I wrote a poem that featured him for I don't know if you've ever heard of the Buzzcocks. Have you heard of the Buzzcocks? The punk band?
Mm-hmm.
You know, want someone and you fall in love with? Yeah, the Buzzcocks, Pete Shelley. And the main character in this poem is an old man that I met in the pub, but actually the old man was my housemate. And I said that I met him in the pub because I was trying to disguise it. And it got in this book just before Christmas because it was the second anniversary of Pete Shelley's death. Then in January, my mate got diagnosed with cancer and he died. He died just last week. So
I'm sorry to hear that.
This one's for him. The poem is called Marshalling My Thoughts, which makes sense when you realise that Tom was called Tom Marshall. So this is in memory of Tom. It's absolutely true, this. And this is Marshalling My Thoughts. I stopped in at a pub on my way back from work. Buzzcocks were on. Ordered me pint. The song finished. Everyone in the pub unconsciously sang the last line. That song is stamped in the collective mind of humanity. I will fall in love with someone you never fall in love with. Do you like them, mate? A fella at the bar. 10 years on me. Old soak. Yeah, mate. I used to know Pete Shelley. Back in the day. Me and my mate saw him on the street in Gorton. Is it him? Is it not him? We couldn't decide. I was starstruck, you'd call it. Quiet as a mouse, like a schoolgirl. We were just kids, Young punks. Shy. Not Charlie. Oi, Shelley! He shouted. Pete turned round. Come on, said Charlie. It's him. Charlie did all the talking. New music, last album, favourite songs, other bands. I just stood staring. Then it was, see you, lads. A week later, we bumped into him again, and he invited us round to his place. I've never seen so many records. A wall full. He was playing us electronica, European. This was 79, at the cusp of a new scene. It was a beautiful place, but punk as well. Empty milk bottles in the corner, he sniffed. They were disgusting. Then we used to go round often, sniffing glue. Not Pete Shelley, that was what we used to do, what we were into. I remember there was a knock at the door. I'd just taken in a deep breath. Did you ever do glue? Oh, you should have. Transported you into a different place. Space. Cosmic mind explosions. Probably brain cells dying like Popper's does. Anyway, I come round in this big chair, and the chief inspector of police is stood by me. Evening, he says, all suited and braid, stiff cap. I was 17 and shrinking in the chair, literally trying to shrink to invisible. I slid the glue bag down the chair whilst holding his eyes with my I have just pooed my pants stare. But a copper was there to say hello to Pete. His place was a catch-all, a mixed bag of the great and good and lowlifes like me who otherwise would be up to no good. A bit like punk or new wave. One night, full house, Tony Wilson sat in the corner, made a spliff and passed it round. Then he was swearing, repeating over, to himself, over and over, And my mate, been puffing on this spliff, just kicked him in the face, took a run up and hoof, straight on the hooter, then passed him back the joint. Do you know what? Nothing happened. Everything was okay. They were different days. He smiled in his reverie. Nostalgia for an age gone. Oh, mate, Pete Shelley. One of the best.
So, guys, what's your next episode? Where are you going? What are you doing?
So it's called I Wandered Lonely as a Cloud, reference. So yeah, we'll be talking about, you know, walking and parks and, you know.
Oh, man. Ah, I've got to take you on my favourite walk. Come on, guys, let's go to Derwentwater.
Derwentwater? Where's that?
Oh, it's in the Peak District. You'll love it. Trust me, it's great.
Cool, yeah.
Okay.
Brilliant.
Matt, how long is it going to take us to get to the Peak District from here?
A couple of hours. Maybe three. 2-3 hours.
2-3 hours. Perfect. Perfect, perfect. Well, tell you what. Would you both like to hear a poem?
Yeah, sure. Always.
Okay. It is an ancient mariner, and he stoppeth one of three.
No.
By thy long grey beard.
No, not this. Matt, could you just turn on the radio?
The bridegroom's doors are opened wide, and I am next of kin. The guests are met, the feast is set, mayst hear the merry. Thank you.
This show was recorded at a social distance and according to COVID guidelines.